בריח אור הנים נישא ברוח הארבעים עם כל פעמונים ובתרדמת אילן ואבן שבויה בחלומה העיר אשר בדד יושבת ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור הלא לכל שירייך אני כינור ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור הלא
Well, that Jerusalem of Gold, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to look at important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to be talking about how the World Council of Churches, the WCC, demonizes Israel. And joining us for this show is Dexter Van Zyl. He is the Christian media analyst for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis, or CAMRA, as it's known. And he's been reporting on the World Council of Churches for some time now. He wants to talk to us about the history of the World Council of Churches and its animosity towards Israel, and recent events involving the WCC and the a webinar that was hosted last February 6th involving the moderator of the WCC, a South African apostolic faith mission pastor, Frank Ciccone, if I'm saying his name correctly, who is the moderator for the WCC's Churches Commission on International Affairs. Well, welcome to the show, Dexter.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. How are you?
Oh, excellent. Yeah, Dexter and I, we've known each other gotten to know each other with our writings on issues involving Israel and other related matters and various threats to Israel. Well, first starting out with what is the World Council of Churches, Dexter?
Okay, the World Council of Churches was founded in 1948, just a few years after World War II, the same year that Israel was founded, largely to provide a response to a lot of the problems that existed in Europe and in other places throughout the world after World War II. And it in many respects, it dealt with problems related to refugees and essentially like poverty throughout the world. And one of the things that it did was that it decided that it was going to become a prophetic voice in reference to some of the problems facing humanity. Initially, it was basically trying to help the poor and the impoverished, materially, and also to help the churches that were operating in these environments. But what has happened is that over the years, essentially, it became infiltrated, and I know that sounds crazy, but largely infiltrated by the Soviet Union during the Cold War. In the very first few years it was founded, it was generally regarded as a pro-Western institution, and the Soviets regarded it with suspicion. But what happened was is that the Soviets started to send in operatives into the WCC. I mean, and I know it sounds crazy. I don't even really like talking about this, but they were KGB operatives that actually worked in the headquarters of the World Council of Churches. And also, one of the things that happened was is that the churches that were operating behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War, they would send delegations to WCC events to basically protect the Soviet Union from condemnation by the World Council of Churches, whereas the Western churches that were belonging to the WCC, what they would do would be to essentially use the WCC to condemn the foreign policy of the United States. And so in the very same meetings, people would say, don't say anything about the Soviet Union because it's just going to be used for propaganda purposes. That would be what the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church would say. And then the Western churches would say, yeah, but we have to condemn the United States. And so, but the WCC has about 110 member churches throughout the world, represents about, I don't know, 500 million Christians throughout the world. It's, you know, it's, or comprises of that many. And a lot of the local members of these churches don't pay very much attention to what the WCC says. But essentially, it takes the anti-Israel line that you can see at the United Nations and dresses it up with religious language. That's basically what it does.
Well, that's interesting. Wow, so it really got infiltrated with that then, because so many of their church members, the constituent church organizations in the WCC, they were all then behind the Iron Curtain. So people then coming to the WCC, they were really just, yeah, they're just under Soviet control and so puppet
right.
churches.
And, yeah, and there was actually a report that was done by this, the U.S. State Department. And I don't have the report in front of me, but one of the things that it talked about, and you can find it online if anybody challenges us, one of the things that they talked about was is that how essentially there was a women's conference that was supposed to promote the interests of women throughout the world. And the delegates were essentially given, you know, a script to say by activists from the Soviet Union, you know, or agents from the Soviet Union. And the interesting thing is that essentially the same thing has happened in the Middle East. What has happened is that we have Christians that live in Muslim-majority environments. They are essentially, you know, operating on behalf of Muslim governments, and they have been deployed throughout the West to essentially promote anti-Israel propaganda. And one of the institutions that they've had the greatest success with is the World Council of Churches. The WCC has two institutions, two bureaucracies, that are basically created to do nothing more than beat up on Israel. And the first one was the Palestine-Israel Ecumenical Forum that was issued, that was founded in 2007. And they helped create the Kairos Palestine document, which Palestinian Christians have been using to promote the BDS campaign. And then they also established the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine, Israel, which sends Western activists from, you know, the United States, Europe, and England, and also even South Africa to basically monitor the confrontations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And they always go back home to tell stories of Jews and Israelis behaving badly. So it's a very, very unfortunate set of circumstances is that the WCC has been hijacked by essentially two captive churches. The first one was the churches living behind the Iron Curtain. Then the second one is the captive churches behind living in Muslim majority countries. And the thing that frightens me is that it may very well be happening a third time as well, because right now, the if you go to the World Council of Churches website and plug in the word Uyghur, which is basically a reference to the Uyghur Muslims in China that have been subjected to what a lot of activists have declared cultural genocide, you will not find one word of condemnation. Not one word. You won't even find the word Uyghur showing up on the World Council of Churches website. And so, you know, I've talked to people who know about the ecumenical movement, and they said, oh, yeah, that's par for the course. You would expect that. You wouldn't expect the WCC to say anything, because the member churches that are affiliated, and there's not very many of them, it looks like there's just two, they're both controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. It's explicit. Everyone knows that the church, the institutions, the Christian institutions in China are essentially dominated and overseen by the Communist Party. And so there's no way that the WCC would ever speak against the interests of the Chinese government, because if it did, those churches would be in trouble. They would essentially be oppressed even further than they are. And so what we have is an institution that pretends to be promoting human rights and freedom, but really is essentially an enemy to free governments and free peoples everywhere, and a friend to an authoritarian movements throughout the world. That's really what's going on.
That's interesting. Interesting trifecta there. First, captive Soviet bloc church, and then captive sort of Middle Eastern Muslim majority lands church, and now a captive Red China, Chinese People's Republic of China church. All these churches, and so this World Council of Churches that being founded in 1948, is that what its self-proclaimed main mission is to advocate for the human rights of Christians?
Well, that's pretty much what it's done. You see, now that's the interesting thing. That's really not, they will stay away from those issues. They say they want to help Christianity unify itself and speak with a unified voice about issues. But when it comes to, to a certain extent it has on some issues. For example, when it came to fighting, apartheid, it was somewhat silent, but essentially it has promoted anti-apartheid activists from South Africa, and Frank Chikane falls into that category. But essentially they want to speak with a unified voice about a very particular set of issues, and most of the time those issues have to do with condemning free countries. And maybe those free countries do deserve to be criticized and condemned. Okay, but the fact that they only speak openly about a certain set of problems, and to be fair, they have spoken about the coup that took place in Myanmar, okay, possibly because they don't have a large Christian population that's present there. But for the most part, they condemn free countries for their policies, which may or may not be bad, but they remain largely silent about obvious human rights catastrophes taking place in unfree countries. And that's the problem. Because when you have that imbalance, you cannot help but end up becoming part of the propaganda war on behalf of authoritarian movements in the world. And that is the hallmark of what the World Council of Churches is. It's essentially it's a tool that authoritarian governments have learned how to manipulate and infiltrate, so to speak.
Well, and then speaking of the World Council of Churches, you mentioned it's an organization whose churches represent some 500 million Christians around the world. Where are these churches distributed? Are they just all over the world, or is there any particular concentration of the WCC?
They're actually pretty well distributed. But the interesting thing is that in China, there's only two. And that is really interesting because we think that there are millions of churches throughout the world. But most of them, they have member churches in North America, Latin America, Africa, Asia, and the Middle East in Europe. And the thing is that in order to qualify, I think you have to have a membership of at least 50,000 members. And so the thing is, they're not all, not every church is a member. They're the evangelical Protestants that are largely supportive of Israel. Those churches and the Pentecostal movements, they are not typically members of the WCC. A lot of them would be essentially like the mainline, and there's a little slippage here. The categories don't work perfectly. But they might be like the mainline churches here in the United States, the more established churches in Europe, and the more established churches in the rest of the world. And what it is, it's basically a church bureaucracy on a world level for some of the more mainstream churches. And when I mean mainstream, I might be somewhat ironic because right now the evangelicals are growing, and so are the Pentecostals. And the one group that doesn't belong would be the Catholic churches because they're represented by the Vatican. But the thing is that the Vatican and the World Council of Churches do engage in a fair amount of dialogue between themselves, you know, amongst themselves. And they generally – and they do have observers that will go to one another's global meetings. And so essentially what we have – they're basically the – it's kind of like the United Nations for the churches. For a particular set of churches. And then there's another organization called the World Evangelical Alliance that plays the same role for evangelicals and Pentecostal churches throughout the world. And they're a little bit better about these issues, in large part because I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that that's what their membership demands. The membership of a lot of the WCC member churches, they don't really care what the WCC says. But the problem is that the WCC will lend credence on a global political or diplomatic level to a lot of anti-Israel and anti-Western agendas. That's the problem.
Well, talking about these sort of controversial issues at the WCC, has the membership been growing or declining? Has there been any fluctuation in terms of churches leaving or joining the WCC over the years?
No, you see, now that's the thing, is that I haven't really detected that. That's not something that I have looked for, and I should look for it in the future. But the thing is that if there had been some sort of decline, it would have been written about it. I probably would have come across it. That doesn't mean that there haven't been people that have condemned it. What happened was is that I think at some point during the 1970s or early 1980s, at one point the WCC actually sent money to a guerrilla terrorist organization in Southern Africa, and I can't remember the details, and I might be able to find it quickly. But the interesting thing is that that money was actually used to promote violence, and that happened a long time ago, and when that happened, it created a tremendous stir. It was not a good thing, and that was what happened was it gave $85,000 to the Patriotic Front of Zimbabwe in 1978. Months after the group shot down an airliner, killing 38 of the 56 passengers on board, terrorists killed 10 survivors. I think, in fact, they may have given the money beforehand as well. But the thing is that the WCC has a history of supporting violent liberation movements in Central America, Africa, and East Asia. And that's not really a good thing for these people to be doing. Because you know, ultimately, a lot of these revolutionary movements, they don't have any use for Christianity. You know, but they will take money from these folks because they're stooges. They will regard these folks as stooges and just take their money. And the thing that really is most troublesome now is that Frank Shikani, who is the moderator of the Church's Commission of International Affairs for the WCC, he's a prominent lay member, so to speak, or he's part of the lay leadership. Even though he himself is a pastor, that's, I think, the language that they use. He's not a staffer for the WCC, but he was a very prominent anti-apartheid activist, and he really did heroic work. He was terribly, terribly beaten and tortured by the South African government during apartheid. When you read accounts of his life, you say, this is terrible. And now he's trying to promote a false equivalence between Israel and the South African apartheid government back in the 1970s, or, you know, during the latter half of the 20th century. And the thing is that that's really not a fair comparison. And because, we could go into detail about that, but the thing is, it's not a fair comparison, but there's still a radical impulse in South African politics, largely, I think, which is a holdover from the resentment associated with apartheid. And there's an awful lot of activists in South Africa that are essentially now trying to redirect that radicalism against Israel now, because you know what happens is that when a radicalism starts to take root, and to be clear, Nelson Mandela figured out a way when he became the leader of South Africa, he was able to tamp a lot of that radicalism down. He really did. And I know historically people say, yeah, he was a communist and he was a member of the ANC. But when he left Robben Prison, he basically said, one man, one vote, and we're not going to incite hostility towards the white South Africans. But I think that there's still an awful lot of anger in South African politics that needs to be redirected, and so they're directing it towards Israel. And it's a very dangerous impulse, and the problem is I think the World Council of Churches is cooperating with that impulse, and that's a frightening thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. As you mentioned, you've written about this before, that Frank Chikane is this noted anti-apartheid activist from the struggle to bring down apartheid in the 1980s. Is that a common expression in South Africa now, that of hostility towards Israel? I mean, here this Chikane individual in this recent February 6th webinar talked about the blood of Palestinians will be on the hands of Israel supporters. You know, I think of like Desmond Tutu, I believe, has also supported the BDS movement. What are sort of the general attitudes towards Israel in South Africa?
Well, you see, now I think there's a split. I think that there are some evangelical Protestants, evangelical Christians in South Africa that support Israel. There are some, what I think we would call them, Christian Zionists. There was a member of the South African Supreme Court who basically expressed support for Israel. And as it turned out, he was ordered to apologize by an ethics commission within South Africa for his pro-Israel things, pro-Israel statements. And I don't want to mispronounce his name, but his name is Judge Magoing. And he basically said that he supports Israel. And what happened was that the Judicial Council somebody submitted a complaint to the Judicial Council, and they said that he needed to apologize because his statements were offensive and particularly provocative. And so they called on him to withdraw without reservation those statements. So there are people in South Africa who support Israel, and we're talking about white South Africans and black South Africans as well. The problem is that there is a very radical element of anti-Zionism in South Africa that has been able to essentially, you know, use the World Council of Churches to broadcast its agenda. There was one volunteer from South Africa that served as an ecumenical accompaniment program in Palestine, activists in the West Bank, and when he went back to South Africa, he said that the victims of the Holocaust have become the perpetrators. And the problem is that because he has an affiliation with the WCC, that's going to have much more credibility than it would if he had never affiliated with the WCC. And the interesting thing is that when Frank Chikane was pushed, you know, I wrote a number of articles about what he said. One of the first places he went was to a internet radio show on Salam Media, which is, you know, which is essentially has hosted some interviews that are like pro-Islamist organizations. There were four activists on one webinar that were members of Hizb-ut Tahrir that essentially called for the establishment of a caliphate in the modern world. And there's no way that you're going to be able to establish a caliphate in the modern world without tremendous violence. And I don't know if you saw the most recent article, but one of the activists who was from Hebron, I actually think she was an American that now lives in Hebron, one of the things that she said during her interview on Salam Media was that you can ask a small child, any small child on the street, are the Jews' days numbered, and anyone will tell you yes. Okay? This is the type of stuff that airs on a radio station that Frank Chikane went to defend himself. And other people appeared on the same radio stations to defend Chikane, and they said outrageous things as well. And so this is the problem is that now we have an official from the World Council of Churches that's using a radio station that promotes anti-Semitism, violence towards Jews and Israel, to defend himself against charges of anti-Israel bigotry. And it's kind of like the people at the WCC, they don't get it. I don't think they really understand what's going on. It would be like here in the United States, it would if suppose I got into trouble, I went on some radio show that promoted anti-black racism to defend myself against charges of bigotry. That's about what he's done. And that's a terrible thing. We saw that also years ago with a guy by the name of James M. Wall. He was the former editor of Christian Century. He attacked Israel left, right, and center while he was editor. He became a commentator for the magazine after he retired as editor, and then eventually retired altogether. And then he ended up posting he became assistant editor or associate editor of Veterans News Now, which promoted the work of David Duke. And the Christians here, that was terrible. It was a terrible scandal. I wrote a lot about it. And they didn't want to – he was a Methodist pastor. You know, he's still alive. He still is a Methodist pastor. Eventually, they took his name off the masthead of the of Veterans News Now. And then they took his name off the masthead of Christian Century because people figured out that you can't have a credible Christian pastor affiliating with movements like that. And that was what Frank Shekani has essentially done in South Africa, is that he's gone onto a radio station where some of the most radical elements of the anti-Zionist movement in the world are given a free rein to say things like the Jews' days are numbered without anybody blinking an eye.
Yeah, that sounds really nutty. It occurs to me, thinking of Israel and South Africa, is there a certain amount of animosity in South Africa? You know, people like particularly anti-Israel people, they always talk about like under apartheid there were various links between Israel and South Africa. For example, I think it's accused that Israel perhaps gave some aid for South Africa's nuclear weapons program when they actually developed 6 nuclear weapons, and also I believe Israel had some sale of arms to South Africa when they were sanctioned by the world community for arms sales. But I guess on the other hand, I believe that if I recall correctly, you know, there were like Arab states as well who helped South Africa bust sanctions by, say, selling oil to South Africa. So does that sort of history play a role in how people view Israel and South Africa?
I think that's part of the issue. And to be fair, I think that, you know, there might be some people that have legitimate anger over those policies. But those policies ended decades ago. And I think essentially for Christians to be affiliating or promoting that hostility over stuff that happened decades ago, and I'm not sure that they have, I want to make it clear, but that's not the type of thing that people should be doing. At this point, if you are supposedly saying that you're promoting human rights and reconciliation, those are not resentments that you want to be stirring up. And I think that's that may not be a pleasant part of the history, but it's part of the history that needs to be told. But I don't think that it's the type of history that people need to use today to demonize Israel, because I think most of the modern the people who run Israel today and who are interested in human rights in Israel and the average Israeli, they probably don't like that part of their history, okay? And every country has parts of its history that are not what they want it to be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, you can compare. I mean, every country, I guess, you know, have to engage in, you know, weigh decisions, engage in real politics. I mean, I can think of, for example, you know, going back in history, like Golda Meir as Prime Minister of Israel or as a member of not before she was Prime Minister, you know, they were, criticized by the Algerians for back when France and Israel had a strong arms relationship, and yet France at the time, before 1962, in Algerian independence, was fighting, you know, against this insurgency in Algeria for independence. And so there's, you know, criticism of Israel of having this relationship with this colonial power, France. And I remember seeing in some docudrama that the response of Golda Meir was, look, you know, France is about the only country in the world that, that sells us arms, so we simply have to get arms somewhere. We need to get arms from France. We don't really have any choice there. I believe there are sort of similar incentives for Israel to have relationships with South Africa in terms of, you know, again, certain technological deals or so forth. But, you know, I guess any country you could say faces sort of decisions like that.
Right, Israel, yeah. And the real politics, you see, but I think that's the real difficulty that I think people are having a tough time dealing with when it comes to the Jewish state. Because what happens is that people think about Jews and Israel in symbolic terms. But the problem is that Israelis and Jews, you know, Israeli Jews and Israelis in general, they don't live in a symbolic world. They live in a real world where they have real threats to their safety and welfare. And the thing is that there are times, and one of the things that I say on a regular basis is that you know, a country can be sovereign or it can be completely innocent, but it can't be both at the same time. And the thing is that people will say, well, you can make that argument about the Palestinians. Well, the thing is that the Palestinians have been offered sovereignty. They've been offered a statehood at least three times since Camp David, you know, Ehud Barak, the Clinton parameters, and then Olmert made another offer in 2007, and they said no three times. And so what we have is that – so why now do we still continue to see Palestinian violence against Israel – even after they've been offered statehood? And so that's the problem, is that they're now trying to achieve, or have historically tried to achieve through violence, what had already been offered to them at the negotiating table. And so that, I think, is the real response. But so I think that's the real issue, is that what we're dealing with is what I would call, and what I think Bernard Harrison would call, political anti-Semitism, which basically portrays anything that Israel does as a much more lamentable and contemptible thing that virtually every other sovereign people and sovereign state has done. And one of the things that Frank Shekhani said in a recent interview on Salam Media was, is that, look, people are complaining that I'm not balanced. You know, I'm not balanced because, you know, I won't talk about Syria and I won't talk about violence in other places in the world. And I just want to take, and his response was, look, when the Israelis take their knee off the neck of the Palestinians, well, then I'll talk about those other problems. Well, you see, now that's that shows an obsession. That shows an obsession with, he's more worried about who does things wrong than what is actually done wrong. And when Israel, the Jewish state, does something that he believes is wrong, he's more offended by that than, you know, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in Syria, you know, the cultural genocide of Uyghurs in China, and the oppression of Christians in virtually every Muslim-majority country in the world. And why is that? Because it's the Jews or the Jewish state that are doing these bad things. He's more offended by that than objectively much more catastrophic crimes. And I don't think that what the Israelis have done qualifies as a great crime against humanity, because when you're dealing with a totalitarian, aggressive jihadist movement that seeks your destruction, you're going to have to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do. That's just a reality. When a free people has to defend itself, sometimes they do things that they would rather not have done. But the thing is that overall, the Israelis have been fighting a defensive war against people who've been trying to destroy them. So.
Yeah, and indeed, you've noted along with others, you know, the total casualties for the the Arab-Israeli conflict. I mean, going back to 1948 up until the present day, our number is something like 60,000 dead, which, you know,
right.
really pales by comparison of, you know, hundreds of thousands dead in all sorts of conflicts
right.
or millions
right.
dead in, you know, Syria
yeah.
since 2011 or, you know, Bosnia in the 1990s or Iran,
That's
Iraq
really
war.
That's really interesting. When I talk about that, there are times when I'm not so sure about my numbers, and so I will say maybe 80,000 or 100,000 just so that I don't want people to accuse me of minimizing the number of deaths caused by the Arab-Israeli conflict. But you're absolutely right, and this is the interesting thing. There was a book called Stealth Conflicts by a guy by the name of Virgil Hawkins, and he documented the amount of news coverage, and he put a graph in the book. During the civil war in the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, 5.4 million people are believed to have died as a result of that conflict. And that those numbers may not be that good because it's very hard to get good reporting, but we know that huge numbers of people died from illness and starvation as a result of that civil war. But there were maybe a couple of hundred articles written about those deaths and the war that caused them. A couple of hundred in, you know, all of the major news outlets, CNN, the three major historical networks, AP, Reuters. He lumped them all together and said that's how many articles there were. It was a very small number, while the deaths totaled in the millions. And then he calculated the number of news articles about the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and I think this was during the Second Intifada. And they were literally thousands and thousands and thousands of articles from all of the same outlets that largely ignored what was going on in the Congo. And so why is that? It's what, I think a lot of it has to do with it's easier to send a reporter to Israel and the West Bank than it is to send a reporter to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Zaire a long time ago. I was not a particularly effective volunteer, okay, but I was there for over a year. I got really sick. And I know how difficult it is logistically to have somebody live in that country. It's expensive, and the healthcare isn't as good. You get sick a lot. You get malaria. And keeping somebody in the Congo is a lot harder than it is to set up a reporter in Jerusalem. And, you know, there was one reporter for the New York Times. I think his name was Ethan Bronner. He used to joke. He said, yeah, if you want to cover Israel, you turn on the radio. You get a debate between two officials in Israel. And then you write about it that afternoon and submit your copy. And the thing is, the same is true with these so-called peace activists, a lot of them affiliated with the World Council of Churches. You can go over to the West Bank, or you can protest against Israeli policies. You can have lunch with a Palestinian family. You can smear hummus with them. You can have them thank you and tell you what a good guy you are for going over to support their cause. And you can feel really good about yourself, and you can have your selfies taken. You can post them on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And then you can go back to Israel that evening and eat at a nice restaurant, either in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and then stay in a really nice hotel and never be far from a hospital. So if you know, so that's one of the things that a lot of these activists do. You know, prior to COVID-19, and Seth Franson from the Jerusalem Post talked about this. He said, this is like, I used to call it, what was it? Theme park activism. They use the Holy Land as like a theme park for their fantasies. And the thing is the World Council of Churches facilitated this. You could sign up for a 3-month tour of duty, in the West Bank, and essentially still live under the security umbrella of Israel. That was the thing. Whereas if you go to Syria or if you go to the Congo or any of these other places, the security umbrella is not there. and the health care is not there. The restaurants aren't there. Maybe Syria, parts of Syria would be nice. I don't know. But the thing is that you're much in much greater danger in any other countries, many other countries, than you are in Israel. And yet you can still show the world just how virtuous you are.
Yeah, I mean,
by doing this
to Israel myself. You've been to Israel a lot, and I've been there now about three times. And, you know, you do get that feeling that if you want it, you can engage in a kind of political tourism, live in Jerusalem, have a nice life there, just like any other modern Western city, and then you can just drive across over into the Palestinian territories or something, and visit over there. And as you say, just come back, have a nice restaurant, nice hotel or Airbnb room. And so there is much greater ease of access. Now, you mentioned, these activists that go over with the World Council of Churches under the auspices of they had this ecumenical accompaniment program for Palestine, Israel, the EAP.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I lost you.
Okay. You did?
Yeah, but now you're back. I got you back.
Oh, I hope you're fading in. You have some time for a person. Who funds the WCC in general? Is it just from churches, or is there government funding or corporate funding for the WCC?
I would check that's not something that I've paid much attention to, but a lot of the money comes from the churches that belong to it. And there might actually be some other NGO money from Europe that will come to it as well. I would check NGO Monitor. A good guy would be, what's his name? Gerald. I can't remember his last name right now. But, he would be the guy to talk to about the funding, because what I do is I just kind of talk about how the credibility of the churches is hijacked to promote this anti-Zionism. So Gerald Steinberg is his name. So NGO Monitor has done tremendous work on this. They do this World Week for Peace in Palestine, Israel. And actually the donors on NGO Monitor's website, they get money from from the Norwegian government. And also a number of NGOs from Germany, the United Kingdom, Finland, and also the Netherlands. And the interesting thing is that they also promote boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Historically, they have been. The problem is that they say we don't support BDS. But the thing is that that's simply not true. They have historically been a central part of this BDS campaign. And, in one of the articles I wrote about the WCC, they responded by – I said that they were basically endorsed divestment back in 2005, I think, in an article, in a statement, their central committee. Well, they responded and said, no, that's not true. We've never responded to we've never supported BDS. And what happens is all you have to really do is just look at their website, and you'll find out that indeed that, yes, they have. On a regular basis, they have regularly supported BDS. Even on their own website, they admit that. And in one article, they essentially said that, we have supported one press statement. We've supported Israel since our founding, since 1948. But if you look at the first meeting of the report on the World Council of Churches first meeting, they said we're not going to take a side and we're not going to even express an opinion about the Jewish state. And so they, even in their own information, they don't tell the truth about what they've said and done. They get the conflict wrong. They don't speak at all about anything the Palestinians have done wrong. And then when they're pushed about the things that they've done, they can't even describe honestly the things that they've done. They say, we're not part of the BDS movement, when in fact they have been a central supporter of it for years.
Yeah, you've written a lot about that. I found interesting, for example, the article you did where you talk about, you know, the founding of the WCC precisely in 1948, just a few months after Israel's founding. And, you know, as you noted in the records of their meetings, the WCC really didn't take any clear stand whatsoever on Israel's
right.
founding. We have a caller here. Let's see if we can bring him in, and he has an audience question here. We'd like to bring in the caller. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Hey, this is Hank Jones from Hank Jones Polysports. And I'm on Wednesday tonight. So I, is finally getting a chance to listen to you live, Andrew. So thank you, for me being able to do it and for me being able to participate a little bit. You were asking about the World Council of Churches funding. Isn't it a lot of denominational funding, like the
yeah.
Presbyterian Church USA? I don't know about the Catholic Church, but I know the Presbyterian Church USA yeah. and I believe the United Methodist Church, both are big funders of both National Council of Churches and World Council. Am I right on that, or am I?
Yeah, I don't have the exact numbers, but in order to be a member in both the Presbyterian Church USA and any of the mainline churches, they're all members of the WCC, they
yeah.
have to they have to basically kick up money to the WCC. And so
right.
and so that – so their big support – and the thing is they're just – that's their dues, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so that – yes. So most of the money comes from the churches itself. The problem is that when I try to get people excited about what the WCC does and say, look, you guys don't agree with this, they just kind of shrug their shoulders. They'll say, you know, because that's just part and parcel of being a member of one of these churches that supports the WCC. The, you know, the folks who run these churches, they do what they want. They say what they want to say about politics or human rights in the world, but they don't say very much about anything else. But the thing is that the members of these churches just kind of shrug and say, well, that's just how it is.
Unfortunately, yes.
That's
well,
a great
well,
question.
Well, yeah, thank you for
are
your
you
question,
a member
Hank.
Are you a member of the denominations I was talking about? Or?
Nominally. I was born and raised Presbyterian USA. I was actually, well, before it was Presbyterian USA, when it was United and you know, the Southern and all that. And then I left them in, like, 2013 and became a member of a United Methodist Church. But it was really, it was just same thing, different collar, different people, you know, I mean, but it's the same. I mean, about the only difference is their recitation of the Lord's Prayer. Other than that, from the political spectrum, yeah, they're all the mainline denominational churches are the same in that regard. They give lip service to being, you know, non-political or apolitical or whatever, and their leadership is anything but.
Right, and that's it's sad because the people who belong to these churches, they want to make the world a better place. They want to take care of their families. They go to church so that they can essentially be part of the pillar of the community. And but the thing is that the money that they send to these churches oftentimes is sent to political movements and political agendas that they wouldn't support. And that's a very problematic thing.
Yeah, and that might be a problem with the dual relationship or the dichotomy, if you will, of you know, the old think globally, act locally. Well, as long as the quote-unquote the masses are acting locally, those who want to really think global can do it at their own leisure and at their own beck and call. I mean, they almost like they don't have any accountability to those that are
right.
that are living and acting and suffering locally.
Yeah, that's really the issue. And when I first started out doing this type of work, I had kind of this belief that, well, once the people in the pews figure out what's going on, they're going to rebel against it. Well, the thing was is that to a large extent, the people in the pews understood that this was the problem all along, and rather than fight against it, they would just leave. They would that was how they – and that's one of the things is that at least in the United States, the biggest – WCC member churches, I think, would probably be the mainline churches that have been dying essentially since the 1960s. They've been losing members hand over fist. And so people who are in the pro-Israel community say, why do you even worry about these churches because they're dying? And I say, well, because culturally they still have a lot of influence. And whenever anybody needs to protect themselves from charges of being irreligious or wrong on these issues, what happens is that they will go to these churches, the mainline churches, and they will provide religious and spiritual and theological cover for agendas that most people in the Christian world will not accept. And the interesting
anything with biblical.
Right. See, and that's the thing. The interesting thing is that what has happened is, and there's a supersessionism, particularly in the liberal Protestant world, and it's a political supersessionism. Historically, there's been an awful lot of people that thought that the church replaced the Jewish people and the planet, okay, and that there was essentially no more use for the Jewish people. And the thing is that the continued existence of the Jewish people is a mystery that a lot of Christians have a tough time confronting. The thing is that a lot of these churches have embraced kind of a political supersessionism that ultimately is going to supersede or replace Christianity itself. They embrace these utopian worldviews and these utopian agendas, which in turn basically would make the church unnecessary, to make Christianity unnecessary. Because if these utopias worked, humanity would be perfectible, and if that's the case, then why do you need Jesus? Why do you even need Christianity? And the thing is that that's one of the reasons why they attack Israel, is because historically, the one group of people that has always basically kind of denied or said no, thank you very much to any of these utopian revolutionary political movements has been a remnant of the Jewish people. They're saying, no, we're good. We're Jews. We're staying here. We're not going to embrace this utopian worldview, whether it's communism or social. And to be fair, some Jews did become communists. They did become socialists. But there's others that are saying, no, we won't. And the thing is that I think the hostility, and this might interest Andrew, is that the hostility towards Israel is oftentimes noted is rooted in this hostility towards nationalism itself, okay?
Yep.
And
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Irony is these mainline churches were, in fact, part of, like, the national church of the United States for many years. Now they've become anti-nationalist. And there are problems with nationalism, and nationalism needs it needs a conscience. It needs people who offer up a prophetic critique. But the thing is that these churches, they've basically become anti-American in many respects. They don't even like their own mission fields. The one thing that they don't like is basically, God forgive me, but cisgendered white guys, the United Church of Christ, the church I grew up in, they promote a whole bunch of, enmity towards white people through white fragility and I'm reluctant to even mention it. But the thing is that the vast majority of the people who belong to this church are white people, and they are basically holding them up as the sin, that these people they're insulting their baptismal dignity by doing this anti-white agenda. And the thing is that the anti-Israel stuff is part and parcel of that. And because the Israeli Jews have said, yes, we're going to maintain our national and cultural and religious identity, and we're not going to abandon it in favor of some utopian worldview. And that is a very, very frustrating thing for some of the cultural radicals that run these mainline churches and who affiliate with the WCC and use the WCC to promote that agenda.
Well, Dexter, you bring up a lot of the issues there. Looking at the WCC with all these problems, what sort of possible reforms could take place at the WCC? What could members of their local churches do about this? What would you recommend?
Well, I think the first thing is that they need to write the leaders of their own denominations and say, we support the WCC, and on one level, we are accountable for the things that the WCC has done. And they have promoted hostility towards Israel and towards Jews on a regular basis. And they'll say, no, that's not the case. But when you demonize the Jewish state, you're demonizing Jews worldwide because most Jews support Israel. And that's the first thing. Then they need to also talk to their own pastors and say, look, we're part of a denomination that supports the WCC. They don't speak for us. When are we going to start to voice our objections to what this organization has done? It has a well-documented history of siding with Western democracies, against Western democracies, and siding with authoritarian political movements. And that affects our material interests right here where we live. And it may not happen right away, but why are these people supporting authoritarian movements that want to undermine the very rights that we enjoy when we come to church? And that will take a long time to make its way through these churches. And the thing is that in 2022, there's going to be a World Council of Churches meeting in Germany. And so I'm going to be writing about the problems with the WCC pretty substantially to hope in an effort to kind of wake people up about this problem so that maybe at some point somebody will say something on the floor of the meeting in 2022 and say, look, we got a problem. We side with authoritarians all the time. And we're quiet about the things they've done wrong. We need to repent for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess as the saying goes, you simply need more sunlight. Well, thinking of you mentioned this idea of captive churches. Now that's a concept that is particularly applied to churches in these Muslim majority countries. Are attitudes of Christians in the Middle East towards Israel changing? I mean, you think of Israel as in recent decades has been precisely the only country in the Middle East that has had a growing Christian population in contrast to these other Christian populations that have just suffered extreme repression or in the case of under the Islamic State, Daesh, genocide even. Do you notice any change among Christians in the Middle East towards Israel and their attitudes towards the Jewish state?
Any public church, their leadership is probably going to typically remain silent or opposed to Israel. But if there's an underground church in any of these countries, an awful lot, and there are some, and I don't want to say anything, but there are underground churches, and if you are able to hear what they've got to say, they still regard Jews as God's chosen people. And one of the reasons why, I think, is because they want to know that God doesn't abandon his faithful who suffer for him. And so any church that has embraced suffering as part of its genuine experience is not going to beat up on Israel, particularly in Muslim-majority countries. And that's one of the things that I've seen is that people who endure persecution on behalf of Jesus are generally pro-Israel. They just are. And I don't understand it, but that's a mystery, but that's how it is.
Yeah, that's a very interesting analogy of followers of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, relating their persecution to the persecution of Jesus' people, the Jews. Well, how about,
right.
should Christians around the world, should they just simply then, are there any alternatives to the WCC? I mean, why belong to the WCC? Could Christians just fulfill whatever political agenda or goals they want to outside of the WCC? Are there alternative organizations to look to?
Well, I see now the thing is that if they are interested in the persecuted church, there's a whole number of organizations such as Voice of the Martyrs, Open Doors, that will actually advocate for Christians suffering under Muslim rule. And so what they can do is they can make their voice heard that way. The problem is the churches that belong to the WCC, that's a bureaucratic relationship, and both you and I know that bureaucracies are very difficult to change. Once they, it takes a cataclysm to basically change a bureaucracy once it's in existence. And so, but the thing is that we may see some sort of, there's a sense that the world is changing. I think both you and I know that. And I've talked to some people about that, and they say, a lot of the, and I don't like using the word elites, but a lot of the elites are the people in charge are basically governing their institutions like it's still the 1960s, 70s, or 80s. And it's not like that anymore. It's not like it was 50 years ago. And there are, material interests that need to be recognized and real theological concerns that they need to speak about, like the mistreatment of Christians in Muslim-majority countries. And eventually, I think that's going to hit. I think that's really, and as the mainline churches continue to shrink in the United States, at a certain point, people are going to say, look, why are we even listening to these people anymore? And that will be a very powerful moment. And then hopefully a new set, new establishment, and that's pretty much what I'm thinking may happen, some sort of new establishment that's more pro-American and pro-Western and more committed to maintaining things than dismantling the West will kind of take up the charge. That's what I'm hoping.
All right.
For.
Well,
I think.
Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to Dexter Van Sile, the Christian media analyst for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis Camera, discussing the problems of the World Council of Churches, the WCC, and its demonization of Israel. I hope you'll join in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host here, Andrew Hare, where we'll discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And Dexter Van Sile, thank you for joining us here on the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. It's good to talk to you.
Good talking to you.